Okay, everybody, it's time for us to turn around and take advantage of the opportunity in front of us. Tonight, I want to take the chance to talk about some of the profiles in the pandemic. So in this particular series, we've been looking at some of the lives of some of the great Jewish historical characters and how they handled their pandemics. It's like my teacher, Mr. Leo Padalino, used to tell us and stress to us, those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it again. And so therefore, it's always important for us to make sure that we're learning from history, not repeating it. And so tonight, I want to tell you a little bit about a particular episode concerning the Ramah, about his life, about his times. We know the Ramah very well. We live and we talk about the Shulchan Aruch and the period of the 1500s. We know that there were two great pillars who were controlling the world at that time, the world of Jewish scholarship. In the land of Israel, we found the author of the Beis Yosef, Rav Yosef Cairo, who was a world-renowned scholar, was accepted to be the ultimate person with whom to restart Jewish life, and certainly perhaps even to turn around and restart the idea of smicha, of the ability to grant a smichas chachamim, and he was involved at that point in time. And then in Europe, we had, at the same point in time, we had Rav Moshe Rabbeinu. In fact, these two people seemed to live life so far in parallel. They wrote similar works, then they wrote similar backup works. It seems from certain historical sources, they actually knew each other. And so they certainly had opportunity to converse with one another. And so tonight, although I could spend months and months talking about the Beis Yosef, in honor of the Yahrzeit of the Ramah, which was held on Lag BaOmer this week, I thought we'd spend a little time talking about him. I think in order for us to do so, perhaps first, before we get to the Ramah, we spend a moment just understanding Jewish communities. We have a general rule in life that, the sunrise, sunset. What a sunrise, sunset. There's a certain understanding that we have within our lives that, as the sun goes up and the sun goes down, and the Gemara says in Megillah, the Gemara tells us that before the sun sets in a particular situation, the sun rises in another situation. The Gemara says, "Vezarach Hashemesh uva Hashemesh." Right? The pasuk tells us that in Koheles that what the sun shines before it sets, and that's what the Gemara says in Megillah. Before the sun sets on a particular generation, it's already rising in another place. So before Moshe Rabbeinu died, Yoshua was already on the rise to be there to sort of catch the slack. Well, the same way it's true for individuals, it's also true for communities. And that often we find when we study Jewish history, we find that as the Jews were traveling, especially in the Galus, we found that before they already had sunset in a certain, they were already on a sunrise. We found that, of course, most obviously at the time of the Churban. When the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the Jewish community went where? To Bavel. But when the Jews that were there at the time of the destruction of the temple got to Bavel, did they find a wasteland of Judaism? No, because prior, 11 years prior, God had already arranged it that the Choresh and Mazgir, the Talmidei Chachamim, would be taken into Galus in advance, creating an infrastructure, creating an environment whereby they would be ready for the growth of the Jewish community. Well, if I talk to you about the modern era, I'm talking about the one we're living in right now, where we talk about the growth of the United States Torah community. And the United States Torah community is a tremendous community as well. What we, when we go back through history and we study, the explosion of Torah in the community at large, we will find a major difference between prior to, I would say respectively, the 1930s, 1940s, and post-1930s and 1940s. And certainly with the major difference in the growth of the community and the change in the community being immigration and the Holocaust. So as Europe began to get Judenrein, was already destroyed, there were many Gedolim who said, you can't go to America, it's a trade for Medina. And others told their people, listen, be aware, the next great vista of Torah is going to be our Achenu Shebe America. We once, I think in passing, talked about Rav Ochanan Wasserman, who was very opposed to Jews going ahead and throwing what he felt was throwing away their lives in the Golden of Medina. But in the last end of his life, as he was being led to death in the Holocaust, turned to the rest of the people who were with him, and he said to them, "We better make sure at this point in time that to realize that we are Karbanos, and we're here hopefully to be Mechaper on the next generation in America." This is already Rabbi Chanan Wasserman's understanding. So we know that as one sun rises, sunset. What people don't spend a lot of time talking about is the community in Europe and how it grew, right? We understand that there was Western Europe. We know that a couple of years ago, and I think you can find this online, we spent one Tisha B'Av talking about the Abarbanel. And we noted that he lived at a particular critical period in time, which was known as the period of the
explosion. Golden Age.
He lived in the Golden Age where? In Spain and Portugal. Mm-hmm. And he certainly was an active participant in Spain and Portugal, and of course suffered at what point in time? When the expulsions happened, both first in Spain and in Portugal. And when was the expulsion from Spain?
1492.
And keep that day in date in mind as we try to figure out something that we don't find at that period in time. And what's that? A Polish Jewish community. Now we talk about Polish. What are you talking about? Look at all the great Gedolei Torah for all the different generations. Believe it or not, there was a period in time where the Polish were not in charge. In fact, the Western Europe and certainly the the German Austro-Jewish community going into the 15th century, that's where the big part of Judaism was strong in the Ashkenazic world. Unfortunately, though, when Jews have a strong peace in a world, there tend to be a lot of people who are jealous of them. And so that was certainly the case in the 14th century, going into the 15th century. And that is the case at other points in time as well. So the Jews suffered under the Germans at the time of the blood libel, with blood libels, with anti-Semitism, with losses of money. They were being, secular world, especially the lower economic strata of the secular world, started to not do as well financially. They needed a scapegoat. And who became the scapegoat, as happened so many times throughout Jewish history? It was the Jews. And so the Jews seem to be doing better than the general population financially, not as great as the aristocracy. And so they got beaten out in the middle from both sides. Just to point out, the Christian community, the Austro-German community was also a very, very religious community, which meant that they were very, very cuffed to their popes. And at a particular point, our popes Paulus IV and Pius V, who were Yimach Shemam V'Zichram, who were particularly bad for the Jews. And so what did they do? They realized that in order to score points with the masses, it would rouse up their masses to make the Jews the scapegoats in their lives as well. And so, of course, this causes major problems within the Austro-German community at the beginning of the 15th century. So the Jews say, look, why are we doing all this? And so more or less, they start to leave to Poland. Why are they leaving to Poland? Because they think, I'm going to leave Germany. I'm going to leave Austria. I'm going to look for a chance to find freedom and economic relief. And so they get into Poland and they look around and they discover, hey, Poland has a very unique system. What's the system? Poland has a lot of countryside, a lot of land. The system in the government was to divide up the lands among a series of landowners. They were known and, of course, made popular through the rise of Hasidus many, many, many years later as the Parits. There are a lot of stories about the Polish Parits. What is it, Polish Parits? A Polish Parits would be a real estate owner. He wasn't always the wisest one in the world, but he owned the land. And so therefore he would put the Jew in charge of collecting all the stuff to be the agent on real estate. Maybe that's a prelude for Jews being involved in the real estate industry. And then, of course, the Jew would apportion it out to serfs and other people who would work well. And, of course, the Jew would be the middleman in these situations. And that became a system whereby the Jews realized they would be able to survive. In fact, in 1334 already, the Jews were given permission to live throughout Poland. And that was the case. The king was very comfortable with them. And it's so much so that in 1447, the rights of the Jews were expanded. It was good to have the Jews, said the Polish king, the Polish kings, because it was good for the Jews. It was good for their businesses, so much so that by the beginning of the 1500s, there are about 1,500 Jewish merchants living in Poland. That may seem like a small number to us when you consider it to say Pinek, But in the olden days and the olden system, you'd be able to turn around and say 1,500 Jewish merchants. That meant that there were other Jews who were doing other things as well. It's a significant number. So now you've got the Jews. They're making a living. They're recognized. They have their own industries. They're the middleman. Who are they the middleman between? The Poritz, who wants to make sure he gets his money or he's going to take it from the Jew, and the serfs, who don't really like the Jew. And so therefore, once again, this causes a very major pain, because the average Polish person hates the Jew because he's an outsider. Sound familiar? Right? So he looks for the Jew, and he sees the Jew as an outsider. And so he turns around, and he doesn't like the fact that the Jew also has financial success. And now leading the charge over here in this situation, of course, is the other group that had immigrated at that particular time, the Germans. And there were a number of Germans who also wanted a better economic life and thought they'd find it in Poland. And so they also gang up on the Jews, right? And this becomes a historical system that keeps on giving. This is a piece of Jewish history, and it keeps on giving. Think of the fact that, you know, even when we were in Mitzrayim, right? So we find that HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought out Makas Bechoros. And when HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings out Makas Bechoros, he punishes everybody. Mibechor paro hayoshev al kiso, ad bechor hashvi asher achar areichayim. Even the person who's the child of the Shivcha, right? Even that person is subjected to Makas Bechoros. And the commentaries ask the question, why? Why do you do this to them? Right? I understand why you go after Paro, but the son of a maid servant, why would you punish her? The answer is, when it came to putting the Jews down, everybody found a place to stick the Jew at the bottom of the list. And so therefore, and we certainly know that that was the story of the rest of the immigrant community, even in our modern times, even in the time of Nazi Germany, everyone was ready to put step on the Jew when things went in a certain direction. And in the 1500s, this was certainly something that was going on in Poland at that point in time. And once again, guess what? The church was out there aiding in the fueling of anti-Semitism in the big city. So the Jew realizes that it's not good. Every Sunday he's got to worry about what the drush of the local galach is going to be. And so he freaks out. So why do I need that every Sunday? So the Jew, for the overwhelming part of the Jewish population in Poland at the beginning of the 1500s, they said themselves, you know what? Let's go live in the Polish countryside and suburbs. And now you understand why. For hundreds of years, the Jews are living in Poland in little tiny countryside villages known as?
Shtetlach.
That's very good. They're known as Shtetlach. Very, very good. Now, Shtetlach. Yeah, the Shtetl, right? Shtetlach. So when we try to figure out what goes on, this is the situation that brings the Jew. And of course, as I told you, so far there's one major thing that I've left out. We've talked about financial success. We talked about challenges in finances. You know what I left out, which is kind of sad given my title that appears before my name? What about the spiritual growth of the Polish Jewish community? Well, let me tell you, initially, the spiritual growth did not parallel the economic growth. So the communities, as we find in the early books of history, we see that the community is comfortable getting by with one person who serves as the chazan, the darshan, the rebbe, the posik, right? And if you look at modern American Jewish history from the beginning of the 1700s, you will see that there is a parallel there as well. The community doesn't support the religious growth. The community doesn't support the rabbi. How does the rabbi make his money? Basically, he makes his money from donations at the time of weddings and a special collection that they would make on Purim and Simchas Torah. This tells you something about the mindset of the Polish community at its inception. They were more concerned about making money than taking care of spiritual needs. But we find that that started to change at the very late end of the 1400s. And certainly that was the case in the grand year that Marvin mentioned to us before, namely
1492.
So here we go. In 1492, Columbus is disappearing. The Jews are getting kicked out of Spain. All right. They're eventually going to wind up getting kicked out of Portugal. But at the same point in time in Poland, Rav Yaakov Palik, the Maharib, opens the yeshiva in Poland. And he starts to slowly teach Talmidei Chachamim. you're going to start to hear some of these names over the course of the rest of this year, right? You'll hear about a name of Shalom Shachna, and he becomes a leader of the Lublin community. You're going to hear about another individual. His name was, his name wasn't, but he's known as the Maharam Padua. Why is the Maharam Padua important to us? Because he becomes a leader in the Italian community. From a historical perspective, it's important for us to understand that he, too, is a cousin to the Ramos. Now, in the early 1500s, by the time we look at the stock of the yeshiva, this community that for the previous number of years had zero, and you know the rabbi was the chief cook and bottle washer of the entire community, right? By the early 1500s, early, we find that there are over 10 bona fide Polish-trained true Gedolei Yisrael, not just people who are localized, smart people. These are people who are going to become major names on the Torah world screen and stage, going beyond into our time. So you'll hear their names, and they're going to make you shudder. So the community, as a result of having these great people, starts to change its view towards spirituality as well. And so first, they become Tomchei Torah. They like the idea that there's a buzz in Poland now. People are talking about, you know, Poland in the rest of the Jewish community at the beginning of the 1500s. And they first start by donating money and contributing to sort of uplift the value. But then it changes and it goes even further as people start to realize there's something to this Torah, right? And people then also commit not only to supporting Torah, but also into learning Torah, so much so that it became common by the time the Rama was born that you didn't go to work until you were sure to learn something every single day, right? And this is, again, another very fascinating parallel that we find in modern American Jewish history as well. Where if you trace the view of what it meant to be a rabbi from the time of Rabbi Yaakov Abuab and Cantus Exius from Spanish Portuguese up until the post Rav Aaron Cutler founding of BMG in Lakewood and Rabbi Dr. Revels at Yeshiva University among others, I think what you're going to discover is all of a sudden, you know, there was a gradual change, and even the lay people made their attitude different and their approach to Torah being different. And again, very often because they appreciated the scholarship to be found among the luminaries of the generation of Rav Aaron Cutler, or Moshe Feinstein, or Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, or Rav Yosef Dovalevi Soloveitchik, and many, many others. And this was something, you know, that really, really, I believe, has lasting effects ara yomas in a very positive way. Bringing this back to Poland, though, we go back to the capital city. Capital of Poland at that time, Marvin? Krakow, the big city of Krakow. Krakow was the capital of Poland. And of course, that's in that point in time, Poland's controlled by a king. So that means the capital city is where the king was. The king, it was particularly fond of the Jews, right? He knew that he could count on them. He knew they paid taxes. He knew that they knew how to make an economy thrive. And so therefore, he likes to keep a group of Jews in Krakow, and he takes care of them, but he also makes sure that they take care of him, so he taxes them well, and they rise to the occasion. But in order to handle their own system, they develop for themselves a system of government, and they put this government together for themselves to govern the internal needs of the community. And of course, who helps govern the government to make sure that things are done in a just way? So again, Rav Yaakov Kalik's yeshiva is very effective over here, as and particularly in Krakow, because that's where the yeshiva was. And so the Rama, when he's talking about his own history, he talks about what Krakow is all about. And he tells us that in Krakow, even the butchers and the shochtim are all B'nai Torah. Today, that would make you laugh. Of course you have a shochet, it has to be a B'nai Torah, right? But back then, that was not a guarantee. And, you know, there were a lot of people. If you were strong enough, then that's your field. If you're not, think about it. You know, think Fiddler on the Roof, right? The butcher was not exactly, sitting in the Torah classes with the rabbi, right? But it's important for us to understand this background about how Poland was born and to see the amazing parallels to the growth in other places at different points in history. So now that drives us into the world of the Rama, right? Because who is the Rama? Rav Moshe Isserles. By the way, what kind of name is Isserles? for the sake of the conversation, just to be aware that in the year 1994, I had the wonderful opportunity to have a roommate from Switzerland whose name was Rama, right? His name was Mark Isserles, and he claimed that he was a direct descendant of the Rama. This, as we're going to see, should have been an impossibility because the Rama only had one son, and we're going to discover that that one son died very early. We don't know that he had any male descendants afterwards. So how could Mark Isserles, right, Ramosha Isserles, my old roommate and currently a very nice fellow in Switzerland, how could Mark have been the same? Rather, there are other Mark Isserles as well. There's going to be a pretty well-known bankruptcy lawyer. If you Google, you can learn a lot about Mark Isserles. But my friend Mark, my old roommate, he was a very interesting fellow, and he used to insist, we're going to have a good answer to defend Mark. And I still believe he can still be a direct descendant of the Rama. We'll just see how in a minute. The Rama comes into the following type of family. Like I told you before, Krakow is a generally financially upscale community. And the people did well financially there. And like I explained to you, there was a governmental system that the Jews had for themselves just to handle their local political issues. And the leaders of the Jewish community today they would be called Askanim. But in the olden days, they were called Parnasin or a Parnas. There used to be a Rebbe in YU. Then he went over to Turo. His name was Rabbi Parnas. We had a Rebbe in our Masifta for many years, Rabbi Parnas. Rabbi and Parnas, means that he had it all. Right, he was a Rebbe who was able to, on the one hand, take care of his student's spiritual needs, hence the Rebbe, and Parnes, he was Mafarnesosanu, right? He was able to step in and handle the community needs. So the grandfather of the Rama was an individual who was known as Rav Yosef. He had a wife named Gittel. On her tombstone, which you can still see in Krakow, the tombstone of Grandma Gittel tells us that she was quite dedicated to the poor people. Her husband was a well-known Parnas. He took care of people. He respected the people in the community. Two very, very dedicated people. They had a son, Rabbi Yisrael. Rabbi Yisrael was also a Parnas, right? And he was also very well-respected. And in fact, Rabbi Yisrael was so well-respected, he had a great governmental relationship, so much so that in 1551, there were only two people in the entire Poland who were given permission to travel to Vilna to do business without any restriction or oversight. And one of the two was Rabbi Yisrael, the father of the Rama. It's very clear that the Rama thought his father was a super-duper Talmud Chacham. How so? We know that in one tshuva, and this too is just a fascinating side note, we know that his father was a traveler. He did business. And sometimes, ships don't come in at the time you expect them to. Sometimes planes don't come in when you expect them to. So what happens when you expect to get back during a Wednesday or a Thursday, and unfortunately your boat gets blown off course? After all, you're talking about the 1500s, right? And your boat first docks when? On Shabbos. Yeah, you have a problem. Can I get off the boat? Why can't you get off the boat? The tchum problem. So the Rama quotes, when the Shiloh was brought to him in Shalos HaTshuvos HaRama, he says, I'll tell you what my father did. My father stationed himself by the door to the ship, right? When all the non-Jews wanted to get off, they picked them up and threw them off onto the dock together with him. They carried him off. And so he says, once he got onto the dock, he said he only had 4 amos to walk. But you see, my father was very concerned about these types of matters. Now, I'm telling us, okay, this reminds me, I see my wife's on the call, right? This reminds me of a conversation that took place around my Shabbos table about a year ago. You remember all those episodes that happened with the LL planes, right? So we had a group of people got stranded here. And one Friday night, we just got into this very long conversation. What do you do if your LL plane or any other airline plane happens to land on Shabbos? What do you do? Where can you go? Where can you not go? Well, forget about us. The Rama himself quotes from his father of Yisrael. And he says, my father's opinion counts. And his mother? His mother's name was Malkadina. She was also known as Tzedekis. We're going to get back to her. I'm not just haphazardly throwing names around. But together, Rabbi Yisrael and Malkadina have children. 4 sons, somewhere between 1 and 3 daughters. It seems that the historians disagree on that point. And it is the children who begin to use the name Isserles. Why do the children use Isserles?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Marvin. Marvin, when you're a Gabbai, you'll understand. We have a guy who wants to be known as, Velvel. If I asked you what the Hebrew name of Velvel is, you would say?
Zev Wolf.
Zev Wolf, right? Zev Wolf. So it's a double name, English and Yiddish. And if I gave you,
Tzvi Hirsch.
Tzvi Hirsch, Arya Leib, right? Yeah. And these are all double entendres, right? Double repeats. Or single repeats, where you repeat the name in Hebrew and then in a Yiddish style. And so, if you think about where you find the second name Isser, the first name is always, say it louder,
Yisrael.
So the name Isserless, right, means from Isser, from Yisrael, right? Israel's kids.
I knew that.
And so therefore, the Ramah, his brothers and sisters, and their subsequent generations chose the name Isserless to identify themselves. This is why I believe my roommate, Mark Zazangizint, is a direct descendant. His family adopted the name Isserless. Maybe his mother's great-great-great-great-grandma's list, but it's certainly something that would fit, and I don't challenge his history or his yichus one iota. He's a good guy, too. So when is the Ramah born? He's born in 1530, and he grows up in this wonderful home. His father's a tzaddik, and a Talmud Chacham. His mother is quite pious, and so he grows up in this house of Torah. So his father starts learning with him until his teen years, and then early in his teen years, probably after the Bar Mitzvah, he's sent to Rosh Shalom Shachna's yeshiva. Remember we mentioned Rosh Shalom Shachna's, the student of Rabbi Yaakov Palik? So Rosh Shalom Shachna opened up the Polish yeshiva in Lublin, and he goes to learn by Rosh Shalom Shachna. And the Ramah notes that he learns a tremendous amount from his Rebbe Rosh Shalom Shachna, including, but not limited to, the idea that Rosh Shalom Shachna was an incredibly humble individual, and the Ramah also felt that this Nida of Anibus, and you find it that quite a bit in his writing, in his Tshuvas for sure, when he's writing back and forth in the introduction to his two major works, the Darkei Moshe and the Mapa, and even in his smaller works, the Toras Chatas and the Toras Ola, we certainly find quite a bit of a humility in the writing. He believes he got that idea from Rosh Shalom Shachna, and for the rest of his life, he keeps identifying that his talents are a gift from Hashem. And while he's in yeshiva, he starts to meet people, become his friends. You know, and some of these friends are going to be important to us as well, like the Marshal. Who is the Marshal? Rav Shlomo Luria. He's known as the Yamshel Shlomo. He's got a commentary at the back of the Gemara as well. The Marshal is 20 years older than the Ramah, and yet throughout his life we find the two of them going back and forth. And the Marshal speaks of the Ramah with a tremendous amount of kavod. We find that the brother of the Maharal, Rav Chaim Bar Bezalel, who is the Maharal's older brother, again speaks of his learning points and his opportunities to hang out with the Ramah to be very, very special. So this is where he's sitting and he's learning, and these are his friends, and he's got a lot of good things going on. But you know what he doesn't have? A wife. And so if you're learning in yeshiva, one of the great opportunities and signs of the fact that your Rebbe really holds of you is if he gives you the opportunity to marry his daughter. And so Rav Shalom Shachna, at some point in time, marries the daughter of the Rebbe, Rav Shalom Shachna. Her name was Golda, and she was quite young, as we'll see in a second. And at that point in time, he's told to go ahead, and he's offered a position in the rabbinate in Krakow. So Rav Asher Siv, who used to be a professor at YU and wrote probably the most authoritative work on the Ramah, quite a number of authoritative works on the Ramah, so he postulates that this first appointment may have also been influenced by his father, because this was an appointment to this rabbinate that was a Rav Mitam. It came with governmental opportunity. It was a governmental appointment, but it didn't matter because quite honestly, the people literally respected and loved the Ramah to death. And we find that outside of the community, he was also not deemed to be like one of these guys whose daddy went ahead and took care of things for him. In 1549, which is relatively early on, you know, you're talking about a period of time where he's already, 1549, born in 1530. So, you know, he's a 19-year-old guy, and his opinion is being sought around the Torah world. And what is the time, for what issue is his opinion being sought? So this is known as the famous Maram Padua dispute. What had happened was the Maram Padua had printed a Rambam. Someone came to the Maram Padua and says there was a Rambam that was printed. He spent a tremendous amount of money printing this Rambam. And then a Goyisha printer came along and said, you know what? I can print for many, many more than you. Printing press was relatively new. And so he printed a second set of Rambam. And so the individual came to the Maram Padua, who asked the Maram Padua to please Aser, the purchase of until he's in a position where his Rambams are sold or he's going to go under. And so he asks for some oversight. And so the Maram Padua is writing all around Europe to all the different factions. And one of the people he seeks to get to sign on is the Chasam Sofer. What do we learn? We learn that the Chasam Sofer not the Chasam Sofer. He gets the Ramat to sign on. And so the Chasam Sofer points out, and in one shuv in one place, and others point out historically, you see that the Ramah was already held up quite a bit at that point in time, that you're going to somebody so young and you want his opinion to be written. And of course, he notes this in his own letter when he says, look, I'm a pretty small guy, but the Maram Padua asks for my position, and he writes a tshuva, why he feels that the Jewish person should have the opportunity to have his Rambam sold, but he said, and he agrees that there should be a ban, and he says it's just going to be a very hard ban to enforce, and he goes ahead with that opinion. So this brings us to now, and he continues to serve the community at large until the magical year 1552, and I don't mean that in a positive in the life of the Rambam. In the life of the Rambam, there seemed to be three epidemics over the course of one decade, which is pretty large, right? And in 1552, it affects his family in a rather serious way. First of all, Asar Batavius comes around, and Malkadina, his mother, passes away. And then on the 11th of Sivan, Golda, the Rambam's wife, the daughter of Rishalom Shachna, passes away. And from what we're able to tell, she was a grand total of 20 years old, Hashem Yirachem. So the family is sitting Shiva and they're suffering, and this goes on. And 16 days later, Grandma Gittel passes away, right? So in the span of 6 months, all the great women in the life of the Ramah, one by one, die. And all this is going on during a very large epidemic that went from Hey Er 1551. No, Marvin, that doesn't mean he didn't say Tachnunate, right? Until Yud Aleph Sivan, 1552. And so when you look at the charts from the Krakow Jewish community from that period in time, they say in the Pinkas, in the official record of the town, 220 people died in the epidemic. Now, lest you think in the light of our current pandemic, and just in our local space, are you kidding? We grabbed 220 and take it home to the bank. You should just understand. They say in that same period of time, on an average year, you only see 26 people die. So they go from 26 to 220. That's a very major crisis and a very major epidemic. And through it all, the Ramah continues to teach Torah. And the way he handles it is he opens his own yeshiva and he supports all the Talmidim. And he has an opportunity to do so because he's the Ramah and he comes from a wealthy background. So now he's able to go ahead and take care of the Talmidim. And he runs a yeshiva and he supports the Talmidim through his background. So what's unique about his yeshiva? So the answer is he was kind of against the idea of Popol. Basically, the way he wanted his Talmidim to learn was with a simple interpretation to the Gemara. And he says this in his introduction to Toras Chatas, that in his opinion, in his writing as well, my major job in doing what I do is to bring Torah and make it simple. So in Toras Chatas, which is all about kashrus, he turns around and says, I find that people are scared when they hear the word kosher. I want them to be able to go through my work and be able to find out what kashrus is all about in a way that's simple. So I guess you could say he was art scroll before there was art scroll. And we certainly find this in a lot of his writing, especially in his commentary on Shulchan Aruch. Make it clear, make it simple. And he has a lot of great students who are learning, who are known and learn from him. So when you hear names, I'll mention them by their books. You talk about the Levush or the Shloha HaKadosh or the Sma, which is a commentary on the side of the page of Choshen Mishpat. These are all students of the Rama in that yeshiva in Krakow. And this is the way things go. So that's 1552. In 1553, his father, Reb Israel goes ahead and he builds a shul in memory of the Rama's mother. And guess who he installs to be the Rav of the shul? None other than the Rama. And that shul, whether it was initially a wooden shul and it burned down and he rebuilt it into a stone shul, or what happened exactly, that shul becomes known as the Rama's shul, and it stays and it's still active until the Nazis came and destroyed it. Right? That's a pretty long chunk of change over there, right? From the 1500s until then. Now, the Rama's sitting there in 1552, 1553, right after Gittel dies, right after Golda dies, right, and Grandma Gittel dies, and we find that he gets married relatively quickly to the daughter of Rav Mordechai Katz, who was a parnas in town. And we also know is that when you look in the Chevra Kedisha's Rishima, we always mention Golda as the Rebbetzin. She's known as the Rabbanis Golda. She's not identified as Ashes Rabbeinu or Moshe of Israelis. Why is that? And so the assumption is because the Rama later marries the daughter of Rav Mordechai Katz, and that probably happened at the same time, you know, as before they had the unveiling. So in order not to make an embarrassment for the second wife of the Rama went out of his way and just he honored Golda, but he did not want to do it in a way that would be and cast aspersions on the second wife. In fact, so much so that whenever the Rama quotes his Rebbe, Reb Shalom Shachna, he quotes him as my Rebbe. He never refers to him as Mori Bechami. Why doesn't he ever refer to him as my father-in-law? What an honor and a privilege. The answer is he probably remarried soon, and therefore he didn't want to go ahead and proceed. And he has maybe two, maybe three daughters and a son, all of whom the son who seems to have died young, and this is how he proceeds. And of course, the Rama leads the Krakow community for 22 years. He started at 20. He served for 22 years. He dies when? When he's 42 years old. Such a full life. And it ended so tragically in 1570. Now, during that period in time, he seems to have written a lot of major works. He's known for his Toros Chatas, which we mentioned before, his Toros Ha'ola, which is a philosophical analysis of the halachos of building the Beis HaMikdash. And of course, his two major works, the Darkei Moshe, which is a commentary on the side, on the bottom of the tour, underneath the Beis Yosef and the Bach, and the Mapa, which is that, you know, when you say the Rama adds, the Haggah, the Rama adds, and the Shulchan Aruch, we're talking about the Rama as well. And why does he call his second work the Mapa? Well, if the Shulchan Aruch is a set table, who ever heard of a set table without a
tablecloth?
And so he calls his work the Mapa. And of course, he has the Shas Tshuvas HaRama. He has one other work we'll get back to in a minute. Why does he write the Darkei Moshe? So in his introduction, he says, I have one major problem with the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef insists on following only the majority opinion of three rabbis. Who are the three rabbis? The Rush, the Riff, and the Rambam. He says, there are a lot of other guys. I'm an Ashkenazi. What happened to all the Balei Atosfos? And that's not the way we decide halacha, just line everybody up and then figure out majority rules. There are rules to halacha, and somebody has to sit over it and come up with a solution, right? And at the same time, when he writes the Mapa, he says there's another major problem he has with the Beis Yosef. When he goes through the Shulchan Aruch, which is supposed to be there to provide everybody with a halacha, he realizes that the Beis Yosef, when the Rav Yosef Karo, when he wrote the Shulchan Aruch, he has one major hang-up. He wrote it for
Sfardim.
And he totally ignores the Ashkenazic Jewish view. And so therefore, the Rama says he felt it was his responsibility to go ahead and correct that ill. So of course, I mentioned Reb Chaim, the brother of the Maharal, And so he has a major problem with the Rama as well, because when the Rama writes the Mapa, he tends to only focus on Minhag Poland, not the other Minhagim of the Minhag Ashkenaz and the Ashkenazic Jewish community. So, you know, everybody has a problem with the next guy, right? Just something to pay attention to. Now, I also want to mention, I mentioned the Marashal before of Shlomo Luria, and I found a fascinating exchange in the Shaus Chubis Ramallah and Shabbos, where there's this whole exchange that goes back and forth between the Marashal and his distant cousin, our protagonist, the Rama. And he says, like, that, you know, the Marashal had referred to the Rama as Mimosha be'ad Moshe lo kam kemosha. He felt that, to say that there was nobody who rose like Moshe Isserles since the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. The only other time we know about that phrase up to that point in history was when it referred to the Rambam, when they said about the Rambam, Mimosha bad Moshe lo kam kemosha. So when the Marashal puts him in that pedestal, he thinks pretty highly about him. So here's the problem. The Marashal was an ascetic. The Marashal was very Kabbalistic and very ascetic, very, very tough person halachically. When you look at his tshuvas, you see a brilliant individual. I can't imagine that he had a very, very easy time as a rabbi in the community, because his positions are very, very chamor. They're very strict. So at one point in time, he has this exchange going back and forth with the Rama on a particular halachic matter. And the Rama happens to match. And by the way, you know, Aristotle has this view over here and here. Wow, did the Marashal see red? And he starts telling him, I thought you were a Talmud Chacham, and here you are, you're quoting the Rama, you're quoting Aristotle, what are you doing? And so in Siman Vav of the Shaus HaTshuvos Rama, he writes and he explains why he said what he said, and he says, and parenthetically, Emes Me'eretz Titzvach, you have to understand that I take truth from wherever it comes from. He says, Chachma, you know, it's easier to quote Chachmas Hamada, the secular Chachma, than it is to bring up Kabbalah, especially in the time frame when we're living right now, where people don't know too much about Kabbalah, right? So I think this is easier. It tells us something very fundamental about the Rama. It's going to be important for us as we approach the pandemics and epidemics and how the Rama approached them right now. And that is that he believed in using all truth in decisions of halacha and determining human life. He was not afraid of the sciences, and he used them in making determinations about which way one is supposed to go, which is kind of relevant for you and me, especially in the midst of the pandemic we're sitting in the middle of right now, for us to understand that that becomes a fundamental for him as well. There is one other major work of the Rama. It's not major in terms of voluminous size. It's major in terms of its
influence.
I'm sorry?
Influence.
Yeah, and it gives us a certain understanding about his life and his world scope. In the year 1556, the Rama finds himself in the midst of an epidemic. The epidemic is, once again, now remember, we talked about an epidemic that killed out good chunks of his family in 1551, 1552, right? And so in 1556, we find, which is not too much later, he's in the midst of another epidemic. And he realizes he's in this area called Chedlov, right? Chedlov is clearly not Krakow. And he realizes, and he writes this in the introduction, he says, I'm in a place right now in Chedlov because of something he calls Ipush Ha'avir. We're going to come back to that phrase in a second. But the quality of the air quality has gone down, right? It's been spoiled. And he says, I'm stuck here. There isn't enough food. There isn't enough figs and pomegranates to take care, and we're not sure where the next glass of water is going to come from. And so Purim's around, and I have a problem. And what's his problem? Couldn't come up with a theme for Shalach Manas that year. I kid you about that. He didn't have enough things for Shalach Manas. So as he writes to his father, that he sat down and he wrote up an entire commentary on Megillas Esther called Mechir Yayin to sort of be in the place of the Shalach Manas he would have sent his father. Obviously, it can't mean that it's going to stand in the place, because you're not supposed to send Shalach Manas to be Mekayim the Mitzvah to your father. That's not the same thing as Mishalach Manas, especially when your father finances you, right? What he meant to say was he didn't have the chance to bring the Simcha. And what he does in this wonderful Sefer is he writes a philosophical commentary on man and his role in the world. and how man fits within his role in society. And he describes the entirety of Megillas Esther within that context. And that is his introduction from a philosophical perspective to epidemics. But as I pointed out to you, epidemics really affected the life of the Ramah, and it's that life that I want to spend the rest of the shir sort of focusing on. Let me quote the Ramah there in Yoredeya. And it's fascinating because, you know, we have beginning of Yoredeya is all Hilchos Kashrus and how to do Shechita and all this other stuff. And then we hit Hilchos Ribbis and Hilchos and tough in between. We have rules about Bishul Akum and Pas Akum and Jem. And then there's one simon called things that we do and don't do because we're scared of Sakana. It's like the thing about the fish and the meat, right, that we all know about. So there are a whole bunch of those things, drinking wine, water that's been left open.
Water.
Right? Yeah. Although it's all in Simon Kuf Tes Zayin. And in Simon and Sif A of Simon Kuf Tes Zayin, and I want to quote to you, the Rama uses the following language. He says, V'yesh lotzeis min ha'ir b'tchilas ha'layla, b'tchilas ha'dever. He says, a person, V'yesh, how would you translate that? One should, let's say, or one should leave a city at the time of an epidemic. V'lobasofo, not at the end of the epidemic. V'chol eilu advarim heimishum sakana. Right? These things that we've been talking about are there because of sakana. So the Rama takes a position that when we have an epidemic or a pandemic, what should one do?
Leave.
You leave. And when do you leave?
I'll beginning.
Give you letters. A-S-A-P.
S-P.
Right? Get out. And this seems to be based on the Gemara and Baba Kama. The Gemara and Baba Kama, which has been quoted left and right, I must tell you. The Gemara in Baba Kama tells us, Tana Rabbanan, Deva Ba'ir, if there is an epidemic in the city, Kanes Raglecha, bring your legs back inside. And how do you know that? The Pasuk in the Seder, right? Not in the Seder, but at the time of Yitzias Mitzrayim, we're told in Israel, Al Ye'ebatem Al Teitzu, Ishmi Pesach Beiso Ad Boker. B'nei Yisrael, we're told that the night of Yitzias Mitzrayim, they stay inside, right? Stay inside. And not only that, the Omer, the Pag Gemara adds in, Lechami, Babachadarecha, Uskor, Delosecha, Biabadecha, right? Go into your house, close your doors, close your windows. That's the way you're supposed to go. If that's the source, we have a problem. Because what is this? What are we told to do when there is a pestilence in the city?
Leave.
ASAP.
No, that's not what Gemara says. What does the Gemara say you do? Go into your house and lock the doors. Don't leave. Stay home. When are you supposed to leave, says the Gemara? Tana Rabbanan, the Gemara goes a little further down the page and says, Rav Ba'ir, if there's a famine in the city, then Pazer Raglecha, then go running away. How do you know that? Ravina ran away, right? And we remember the four Mitzorim ran away. They said, if we go to the city and the famine's in the city, we'll die there, right? So the Gemara says that that's when you move. The epidemic wasn't about a famine. The epidemic was a cholera epidemic. And then the Gemara goes one step further. Tana Rabbanan, Dever Ba'ir, when there is a situation of a Dever in the city, Al Yahaloch Adam Be'emsad Derech. Don't walk in the middle of the road. In the midst of a Dever epidemic, the one you're supposed to go into the house for, the Gemara says, you know, when you travel, don't walk up the middle of the road. There's Malcham Avis over there. Don't. What do you have to do instead? The Kivan, the Yave, Le Yerushusa, Maski, Lehedja. Right? Since the Malcham Avis is there, he's walking up the middle of the street. Instead, what do? Walk on the sides if you have to walk. Why is that?
Sorry.
Malcham Avis is not going to be in the middle of the street. Come on, Devorah. What is he describing?
It's
safe? Social? Yeah.
The car is in the middle of the street anyway.
I'm sorry?
The cars are in the middle of the street.
Right, I didn't think that was a big problem in the 1500s, but certainly it sounds like there's, you know, going back to the Gemara saw this as a problem. So if it's a famine, you run. If it's a magefa, you stay home. So how come the Ramah goes backwards? Why does he get it backwards? He says the exact opposite. He says if there's a dever ba'ir, right, you get out of there fast. So which way does it go? And by the way, this is a bigger question, because it's not just a mistake, maybe some printer mistake. We just learned something about the Rama. 1556, where was he writing from? Shedlov. Why was he writing from Shedlov? A place that he mentions other tshuvas. I wish I could look into things, but unfortunately I'm not at home. He ran to Shedlov because there was an epidemic in the city. Which way is it? Do you stay or do you leave? Under what circumstances? So there are three opinions that sort of tackle this Gemara, only one being the Rama. The first one goes way, way back prior to the Rama, back to the period of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, Rabbi Yehuda of Regensburg, who lived somewhere between 1150 and 1217. And he said, and he writes in Sefer Hasidim in Simon Shin Ayin Beis, he says, look, if you hear in the midst of an epidemic that it's better somewhere else, what should you do? Don't go there. Because how do you think you're going to get there? You're going to go to the pre-plane, which means caravans. And you're going to travel by caravan. And who do you think is going to be traveling along with you? Our dear friend, the Malach HaMavis. And the caravans carry the disease. And so, therefore, stay away from the caravans. Wow. So let's go over that one more second. Already in the 1100s, the Talmidei Chachamim understood that if you travel in groups, you are on the subways, right? What's going to happen? Here we are, 2020, right? I'm just reading there, folks. It's just what I happen to see. So if I went with Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid tells us, why does the Gemara say go back into the house? Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid will tell you because you can't get out, right? The Rama, our friend, our big speaker tonight, has a tshuva, and he says, I have a difference over here, because he has a tshuva in Simon Chav, where he tells the following story. Guy comes up to him, and he says, Rebbe, I have a problem. What's the problem? I have a house. And I wanted to rent this house. We signed the rental agreement with Chaim Yankel, right? And Chaim Yankel was getting ready to move in. And as he's getting ready to move in, I realize that there's a big problem with Chaim Yankel. And what's the big problem with Chaim Yankel? The big problem is that Mrs. Chaim Yankel has corona. Cholera, right? Hey, she has cholera. And so I have a problem. I decided I don't want them in my house. And I'm canceling the rental. Right now, canceling the rental. So Chaim Yankel comes running to the Rama with him, and he says, you can't do that. We have a rental agreement. So the first guy says, listen, my wife don't want to come back home to a house like that. You can't come into the house like that. She's contagious. New folks, if you had to paskin this shayla, what would you say?
No.
You be the Rama. Do you say yes or no? Does a person have a right to pull out of a rental agreement?
In that situation, possibly.
Possibly, yes or no. Now remember, let's understand the Rama. Remember, the Rama himself feels that when you've got a problem in the city, run away. And guess what he says over here? He turns and goes, no, that's ridiculous. You cannot not rent the house because we would lose... you obviously don't care about that situation. The woman is not sick because of a particular illness connected to her. The real problem over here is an air quality problem in town. You push Avir. And so therefore, running away is not going to help you in that situation. And I know that you have this difference in town with you because, for Bikur Cholim, we do allow people to go in. Some illnesses are airborne. Some illnesses are not airborne. And so how do you discuss Ipush HaAvir? It sounds like the Rama himself takes a position that you have to figure out which illness is which. And some, you can't just go ahead and decide all illnesses are one and of the same, but you have to figure out, is this of the type whereby it is airborne? In which case, maybe you would have a basis for your discussion. Is it a type that's based on something else, in which case the contagion is a different type of contagion. And we find that later in the community of Krakow, about 50-100 years after the death of the Rama, the rules already there was that if a person contracted a major illness, among the things that had to be done right away is you had to tell the local authorities. Why? So I believe you've just found the source for contact tracing. The local Jewish authorities were told when a person was sick that they should be able to monitor who he's having contact with, who he's not having contact with, in order to do what? To protect the community at large. In that same Pinchas, they wrote down that you're not allowed to start panicking and running away. So the Ramah takes a totally different approach than Rabbi Yehuda Chassid. It's not about the Malach HaMavis. It's about just, per se. He says the bigger issue over here is about just worrying about contagion. But you have to know each illness is very different. The Marshal, remember the Marshal we talked about him before? Remember the cousin? So he has a piece in Baba Kama in the sixth parak. It's Chavav, where he turns around and he says, you have to really understand that if it's a dever, you can't run away because you're increasing the sakana. And you also can't run away if it's going to be too late. And he says, maybe that's why the Ramah is coming around, right? Listen to the language. He says, Im kein ein tov livroach befrat achashen eschazek hadever. Once we're in shutdown mode, right, it's not good to run away. You can't run to Israel. Yesh sakana levorchen bein ha'umos yosim in hadever. Kasher bavonos harabim yiduim. When you start moving around from city to city, guess who gets blamed when the epidemic breaks out in the next city?
The Jews.
You got it, right? And we know that. He says the only thing says the mashallah is al mitchila tov livroach. From the beginning, it's good to say, look, if you see something starting, get out before it becomes a Jewish related matter. And he finishes off by saying, look, the fact is, if a dever situation is first beginning, then run away. That's assuming that you have the ability. Unless you are in one category. And what category is that? If you had the disease and you got well, what did the Marshal just describe? Right, Dina, I'm watching you. It's antibody testing. Right? So here we are.
You've had it already. So it's
right? 1500s. 1500s. We're not going to discover the idea of antibodies in modern science until the end of the 1700s. And here's the Marshal. Take a look. Baba Kama, Yamshel Shlomo, Perek Vav, Simen Chavav. There it is, black on white. So what's up with the Ramah over here? Where he tells us he's literally going around and supporting this general position, right? We have to start before it gets to be a difficulty. He also adds an extra comment in his commentary when he's talking about the same matter and when in his commentary on the Torah in the Darkei Moshe. He adds one more phrase. He says, Minhag shel Yisrael Torahu. He says, you should just know that Minhag Yisrael Torahu. Now, Rabbi Dr. Eliezer brought to us a very well-respected Jewish historian in Israel. When I reached out to him in preparation for this year for some source material, he's the famous editor of the Sfarim blog. So he said to me, take a look at this. And he shows me this line and he says to me, by the way, I think he wrote his doctoral thesis, something connected to the Ramah. He says, you should just know in all of the Ramah's writings, this is the only time we find these five words. Minhag shel Yisrael Torahi. What does that mean? Minhag Yisrael is the Torah. Why is that over here? So what does this have to do with anything? So in an article he sent me from Ramosha David Chechik, which is relatively easy to find, both he and Rabbi Dr. Brutt suggest that what the Ramah is pointing out over here is not an obligation. It's a good bit of advice. And that's the language that we started with. V'yesh latzeis min ha'ir. Not umechuyav latzeis min ha'ir. And therefore, he's telling us this is a good bit of advice. And sometimes it's good to realize among the Jewish people that you follow good advice where it takes place. He's like, what you and I would call an underline. And this is one of the basic things we need to understand. So what is the Ramah and the Marshal what are we learning from the period 1556? And what are we taking away from it? So in sum, I think we need to understand that the Rama, in this great big of understanding his life, he got the idea of microbiology makes a difference between different types of illnesses and how to approach them. He got the idea of quarantine. If you can't get away, lech ami bebeisecha. If things are too heavy, quarantine. And by the way, we see that in Krakow, they later extended this idea to include contact tracing, right? He gets the idea of social distancing. He gets the idea of trusting the sciences. And he tells us to follow good advice. Minhag Yisrael Torahu. Minhag Yisrael Torahu is something that sometimes gets challenged in modern times. But when we sit in the midst of an epidemic, it's always good for us to study the periods of history that precede the epidemics, previous epidemics, and how the Gedolei Torah extended them. Because if we get this down pat, we can guarantee one thing. We know that we're heading in a direction where we know that others went before us and they came out strong. And Bezrat Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, give us the wisdom to learn from the Zakenim of the previous generations, take their lessons, and help ourselves survive. So thus, this evening, we've learned about the Rama, we've introduced ourselves to a new period, an old period of history, and seen how amazing it is to see the parallels, and how we can learn from those parallels to learn to follow our Rabbanim of the modern time, as they work together with the scientists of modern time to make sure that we are careful to be as safe as we possibly can. So I thank you all very much, and I wish
thank you
all
you.
A wonderful, sweet, and terrific Shabbos, and Shabbat Shalom to all.
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you. Shabbat Shalom. Because it's-